Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in McAllen Medical Center versus Cortez.
May it please the court, Mr. Roger Hughes will present argument from petitioner.
May it please the court. This case arises out of a situation in which the hospital was caught in a crossfire between competing and rival groups to gain control over what they thought was a wealth of personal injury cases, and the key to that wealth was the list of our patients, which is confidential.
Okay, even if that's the case, has this case slipped away from us? I mean, on the Fourth Amendment petition, it seems that the commonality that forms the basis of class certification that would give you standing here seems to have slipped away. In other words, the claims seem to be totally different.
Well, two things. First, I think under the authorities, whether the certification and standing has to be viewed by the record at the time the trial court ruled. But going one step further, we lost on that question. And the claims against Dr. Bracamontes form a subset of the claims the other plaintiffs are asserting against the hospital. And so literally, I mean, if you take it one step further, if the court were to say to the trial judge were to say now, well, settlement class, based on the evidence before me, I certified a settlement class and forced you to settle with Dr. Bracamontes for nothing. And now when I get around and I hold another class hearing on put forward by the new claimants, who are asserting many of the same things that you were asserting, because it's the same class. It's the class of all cardiac patients during that period. It turns out on the same sort of allegations, particularly the ones involving Dr. Bracamontes, you're not certifiable. I mean, in some sense, that causes the whole thing to unravel.
Well, but you've lost me there. What gives you standing appeared to me, based on the first few petitions in the case, was that the allegations were the same as to you and Dr. Bracamontes, and that therefore the same considerations would go into the class certification question, therefore you had a direct interest. Those claims seem very, very different now. And how do we deal with that? Sure, we can, you know, we could rule your way and say that the court erred in not considering all the certification factors and all that, but where does that leave us with the Fourth Amendment petition?
Well, the first thing is that was one of our grounds for certification, that the conclusion of law that this wouldn't carry over was incorrect, especially after Anakim. And I think after Anakim, there has to be some carryover effect. But it went further than that. It was how the certification process was about to be used. And
but even if everything you say is true,
yes.
What can we do then?
Well, for one thing, decertify, which would have the effect of putting an end to all of this. I mean, the trial court has continuing power to regulate all these notices. It could, based on its earlier ruling, issue more notices of the same kind. It could correct. I mean, that was part of the thing they said is, well, what can we do about the notice? Well, it can correct the notices or order corrections to be postponed, put out to the class members. And the second thing is if this agreement is approved, under the terms of Dr. Bracamontes' agreement, his obligations to cooperate go on forever. They survive the judgment. And in effect, I mean, if I recall the terms of the settlement agreement, even once it's severed out and put into a new cause number, the trial court retains jurisdiction to enforce the settlement. And so he can be called upon to cooperate and provide the information we're talking about, even after there is what would appear to be an otherwise final judgment. And at that point, they may call upon him and say, well, now we'd like that list.
Well, I understand that those are matters of strategy, and I'm not sure strategy is what gives you standing. I'm having a hard time determining, based on the posture of the pleadings right now, how you have standing to say that you are injured in a way to give you standing to contest the Bracamontes settlement.
Well, the standing first arises of that this agreement that he has a tendency to put financial pressure on him to disregard his duty to protect confidential information.
But the agreement reached with Dr. Bracamonte says that he will only produce information that he's allowed to by law.
That's paragraph 15. And paragraph 16 is the one that states that he is to cooperate by providing the names of all witnesses who have knowledge. And that contains no such limitation. Second, the problem here is not just the agreement, it's, so to speak, how it's to be implemented. As we've already seen, the other agreement was implemented in a way in which the information was turned over, I mean, despite the privilege. There are all sorts of ways we've seen to get around to these problems. His duty to cooperate is to do so informally when called upon. Both paragraphs are quite clear. They don't have to send him requests or interrogatories. They don't have to send a request for production. They only have to call him up on the phone or send a letter. And it's at that point the doctor has to make a decision. Now, what if that decision comes at the point when the judgment's gone by, or it comes next week or in 2 months, and Dr. Bracamonte says, well, or let's say after the settlement's been approved, he doesn't have counsel anymore. He decides he doesn't want to talk to his counsel. He just gets a phone call now that he's unrepresented. He says, you've got to cooperate. I want the list. Well, how do we at that point protect? I mean, he's still obligated by the agreement. The agreement puts the pressure on him.
Mr. Hughes, I may not be with you yet on this. Let's assume the hospital was never sued.
Yes.
Bracamonte's gets sued for having misrepresented that he was board certified. And the people want to certify a class, anybody he's served on, and they want him to produce a list of all patients that I guess he served. Now, can the hospital come running into the court and say, I have standing to appeal the trial court's direction to the doctor to do this because we don't want the doctor to violate the law? I mean, is that what this whole argument is about?
That's the inception of the argument. If the agreement is that he is going to turn over confidential information.
So the hospital is not subject to any sort of order to provide any information. They haven't been ordered by the trial court to provide any information or do anything at all.
Well, we were ordered in one sense because we were ordered to send out the notice which made us use the list. I mean, we had to basically stuff the envelopes and address them ourselves, but we had to use the list, which we think was a violation of the privilege. But the answer is, I mean, to take your hypothetical, if it were a separate lawsuit, I think if the hospital would have standing on behalf of the patients, and I think it does, to say this agreement is improper because it violates the doctor's obligations to his patients, and if, as they say, he were the hospital were able, or under the circumstances, the court were to conclude that the doctor is legally liable for the doctor's behavior and has some responsibility if the turnover were improper, I think in that case they would have standing to contest the agreement's fairness.
So your only argument to us really is that you're here to protect, you're here withstanding because the hospital has the authority to protect individual patients from having their names disclosed by that doctor over there who's the real defendant.
That's the first key to the standing, yes. And that if the statutes give us both the ability to stand in for the patients and say, you can't, these are our patients too, and you can't violate their privacy, or for some reason we could be held responsible legally, then that as well. But also, there is one step further. If the ultimate goal of this...
But you're not arguing... I'm sorry. You're not arguing that the trial court has ordered you to do something that you're legally responsible, that you can be legally liable for, because you're not arguing that the judge has ordered you to produce any of this information. You're just arguing that if that doctor over there violates the law, then you have standing to argue on behalf of the patients that he should not be allowed to do so.
Yes, and in the other sense, in some cases, maybe not in our case, but in some cases the hospital may be responsible. But the second thing of it is...
But you're not arguing that you're responsible here.
No, we're not. Well, the hospital is not his employer. One of the new defendants does have an employment relationship with him. The McAllen Medical Center Physician Group is a nonprofit, and there is an employment contract between the nonprofit and Dr. Bracamontes.
Yeah, but you're not arguing that the hospital here has some sort of ultimate responsibility if that doctor honors the trial court order.
No, Your Honor. I mean, they've alleged that we are, that the hospital, McAllen Medical Center, is the employer. We disagree, and that remains to be proven. But at this point, no, we don't agree that we're the employer. But the second thing is, if not just that, if the whole process is to stir up cases against us, and they have, I mean, at this point, they really have sued us, I think that's a positive entry. I mean, that's what was talked about in Bernal, is about the danger of using the class certification process and cutting corners to allow the unfair aggregation of claims to hold to injured defendants who may have little or no responsibility to the people whose claims are being aggregated against them. And so if this agreement has, and it's not just the agreement, I don't think that is part of the agreement, but the terms of the agreement.
With regard to that last point, I'm flexed about something. Are you saying that if you have, to simplify, two different defendants, and there is a rule line class action against defendant one, and the plaintiff's plan is to never have a class action against defendant two, could defendant two have standing to intervene in the class certification?
I'm not sure I've heard the entire thing. You're saying
a class of plaintiffs,
yes,
who are going to pick on two defendants,
mm-hmm.
and with regard to defendant one, the goal is to have a class action lawsuit. With regard to defendant two, for whatever reason, they're going to cut that person out of the class action lawsuit, but nevertheless attempt to maintain legal action against them on a non-class basis. When it comes to the class certification with regard to the plaintiffs in their relationship with defendant one, and defendant one objects to that class certification, does defendant number two, who's not going to be a part of the class action, have any ability, under your theory, to intervene with regard to the class certification, or to object to it?
Well, if they don't intend to certify a class against defendant two, and have no intent to, I would ordinarily say no, unless they were going to use the process of certification in some way to injure that party.
Well, let's assume that they are obviously going to gain benefits through the class certification process of gaining access to an abundance of more plaintiffs or potential plaintiffs. Even if that's true, how is it that defendant number two has standing to participate in objecting to the class certification, and then if it is certified, has standing to appeal the certification?
Well, if the intent of the first certification is to go out and solicit claims against the second defendant, and to do that by using the class notice, the official class notice, then I think the defendant does, because the plaintiffs are asking the court to take an action and basically to put the court's imprimatur on using the notice.
What's the legal basis for your conclusion?
Well, frankly, at this point, this would be a pretty basic first impression on that point, except that there are numerous cases which talk, I mean, in the federal system, they're mostly district court cases, that talk about that it is totally improper to allow the class notice procedure or the class certification procedure to be used as an opportunity to drum up either participation in the case or to solicit individual cases. I mean, they were cited in the latter part of the brief, such as the Lewis case, the Shell Oil case, and a few of the other ones, that
who has
standing to certification.
Who gets to complain about that?
Well, I imagine the defendant who's being drummed up against. In each of those cases that I cited in the brief, there were contested hearings, and they were usually instigated by the defendant. And in each
who was the class certification target?
Well, in most of these cases, the class had already been certified or was about to be certified. And it was, the target defendant. I believe, for example, in the Shell Oil case, the Shell Refinery case out of Louisiana, and they were allowed to complain that that's how it was being used. Now, in that case, the court took other measures having to do with, well, this is then how we're going to certify, or this is the kind of notice, or that counsel doesn't get to be class counsel. But they did get to complain. And that, I guess, is the entry. Now, I think then to say that, well, if the intent is merely to solicit cases, that defendant is just going to have to just defend them, that that's not a positive injury to complain about, is to allow the parties to use the notice, the whole procedure, in a way that's already been condemned. The red light's on them.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Please, the court. Mr. George Brin and Mr. Michael Cadell will present argument for the respondents. Mr. Brin will open with the first 5 minutes.
May it please the court. I'm going to restrict my comments with the court's permission to the issue of standing in this case, and more particularly to the sub-issue of the alleged collusiveness of this settlement, which appears to be, at least to some extent, part and parcel of the petitioner's claim for standing to attack it. The tone of petitioner's argument appears to be that, notwithstanding its terms, which, as the court has pointed out, obligate Dr. Rakamontis to furnish only that information to which the plaintiffs are entitled under the law, that notwithstanding those terms, it must be collusive because it does not provide for the payment of money on behalf of Dr. Rakamontis in exchange for his release from this class action. There is absolutely no evidence in this record of any collusion, that Dr. Rakamontis has acted or intends to act in any way contrary to the terms of this settlement agreement.
But that's not for us to determine, is it? I mean, we're not going to decide in any way in this decision whether the settlement was collusive or not. I mean, that's a subject of the fairness hearing.
Your Honor, I believe that the petitioners are grounding their standing, their claim of standing, at least in some portions of their brief, on the fact that this is a collusive settlement, and by virtue of its collusive nature, they have standing.
But you're not contending this settlement's an end in and of itself. The plaintiffs got together and they worked up a class and they sued somebody for no money damages, and now they're going to go home. I mean, it's a building block to something else, isn't it?
Your Honor, I don't believe it is. Certainly I have not seen evidence of that. I believe what happened here, and I'll comment on that, is that Dr. Francisco Rakamontis was pulled into a fight with this class action that was never his, and that this realization came to the plaintiff.
Well, who pulled him in? The plaintiff?
Yes.
But they don't need to certify a class to get him out, do they?
My understanding, Your Honor, and I have to tell the court I am not an expert in class action litigation, but my understanding is that in order for there to be a settlement, there has to be approval of that settlement by the court in a fair hearing.
If the class is certified.
And I think,
well, if there's not really a claim against him, and there's not any money changing hands, why can't he just be non-suited? Can't the putative class representatives non-suit him?
That would be my preference in the matter, Your Honor. But what we have at this point is this settlement that requires his cooperation, which I suppose could be said to be some quid pro quo. My point that I'm making to the court is there's nothing illicit about the cooperation, at least that I contemplate.
Well,
let's say
we agree with that, and the other issue that I thought they were raising is because they were originally sued along with the doctor on the basis that there were misrepresentations about certification qualifications.
Yes, sir.
And that they did it together, and that these whoever this unknown class was suffered injury. So their argument is, at the time this case started, we were there as a defendant facing possible damages along with the doctor.
That's correct.
And so we have standing to talk about and to contest the nature of the certification order, because they're going ahead over on this path without us, but we can suffer injuries, and you're saying no standing, so you can't complain.
That's correct.
What's wrong with that argument?
Well, here's what's wrong with it in my mind. Many times, plaintiffs sue defendants asserting liability on the same grounds, and many times one or more of those defendants settles the case with the plaintiff for reasons that
But that's a little easier said than done than when you're doing class actions.
I understand, but at the root of the contention, however, here is that this settlement should not be certified, and we believe
The settlement hadn't even been reached yet, if I understand the record. There has been no hearing if this is a fair settlement and the trial court's going to approve it so that it can go to a judgment. All that's been certified is, yes, we're going to have a class that it just includes the doctor patients, and we're going to go that way, and there is a settlement in the works, and it'll be approved later on. Isn't that correct, what the record shows?
Your Honor, I think that's a correct statement, but I also believe that at the heart of petitioner's petition in this case is their right to contest certification of this class for purposes of settling. And we believe that this is not our fight. It became obvious very early on that Dr. Bracamontes made none of these misrepresentations that they are contending as the basis of their class action. The other basis for their class action is that the hospital overcharged for services. That's not Dr. Bracamontes' fight. And finally, and I think of some importance to our position here, the contention that the hospital should have purchased a left ventricular assist device at the advice.
Why do you need to send out notices? I really guess we should say these for Mr. Cadell, since we're already into his time. So I'll withdraw my question.
Well, I have to ask one more. If it's as you say, that the doctor made no representations and injured nobody, seemed to me he should have been the one that be non-suited, and you go for a class against the hospital. But you're going the other way. It doesn't make any sense. Why shouldn't they have the right to say there's something that's amiss vis-a-vis certifying a class under the rule when you can't show damages?
Your Honor, all I can say is that there's nothing in this record to suggest that this settlement is any different from any other settlement where a settling defendant pays cash to settle the case. There's no evidence, no suggestion that Dr. Bracamontes has done anything that is illicit or collusive, or that he has any intention.
So what is then the nature of the class? What's the definition of the class that you're asking the court to uphold and certify as against Dr. Bracamontes?
Those members of the class that asserted causes of action against him and wish now to abandon.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I think there's several interesting questions presented to the court, and I know the court has an interest, a continuing interest in class action procedure. One question that seems to, that I hear this morning that frankly I had not anticipated or had really not thought about is the issue of when you have multiple defendants and a settlement is reached with one of those defendants, and that would necessitate class certification in order for that settlement to achieve the global peace that the defendant would want. Does that certification process create standing for another similarly situated defendant? Now, I'm not sure, given the current state of the pleadings, that this is the case in which that decision should be made, or that determination should be made. I think it's an interesting question. And it may very well be that because of Amchem, Loyed, Burnell, and other cases of this court and others, other decisions, that as we I think, raise the bar on class certification, that if you do have an identical case, if the claims are identical against multiple defendants, there may be an argument, in fact, that if you have a class certification proceeding against one defendant, even in the settlement context, that another defendant who would be similarly situated might have standing to appear and participate in that class certification proceeding because of the potential prejudice that class certification might create for that similarly situated defendant.
It just kind of, Justice. You raised the question about it. You're certifying a class in order to have a settlement against a doctor that the putative class representatives now admit they have no cause of action against. Now, if that were really the case, wouldn't the global class you're talking about you're buying peace from include everybody in the world? I mean, they're claiming he made no representations, he made no misrepresentations, he didn't do anything that we claim that he did. How would you ever define a class that was his patient or a class that he did business with or a class? I mean, it's odd for me to certify a class to settle it when the putative plaintiffs are arguing he didn't breach any duty to them that they claim that he owed to them.
First, Justice Enoch, I would refer you to the settlement agreement itself. I think there's been a slight misunderstanding created by Mr. Brin. We do not concede that Dr. Bracamontes has no liability for the misrepresentations made to the class, nor do we concede that he has no liability for overcharges that might have been connected with those misrepresentations. And in fact, the settlement agreement in the preamble recites that the class is not giving that up and does assert those claims, just as it recites that Dr. Bracamontes contests those claims and by entering into the settlement is not conceding liability. So it's pretty much like a plain vanilla settlement that you would see in many cases, and we reserve our rights and the settling defendant reserves its rights, but we agree to compromise those claims in the settlement.
If there were significant claims, they wouldn't be approved at the fitness hearing.
I'm sorry?
If the claims against him were significant, then the settlement couldn't be approved at the fairness hearing.
No, Justice, I disagree.
You couldn't give up significant claims for nothing and have the trial court approve that on behalf of the class.
Actually, Justice, I respectfully disagree, and in fact, I do it all the time. When we have a defendant who has no money, who has no insurance, and who has no prospect of getting money or insurance, then, in fact, we often settle with those defendants for things that are other than money. Now, in the case of Dr. Bracamontes, we investigated his assets. Had we ever reached a fairness hearing? In fact, it will be incumbent on us to demonstrate to the court and to the class that we've done our due diligence in investigating his assets, in investigating his insurance, and the responsiveness of his insurance to these claims. And also to demonstrate to the class and the court the quid pro quo that we received in exchange for the settlement. His cooperation is important. One thing that Mr. Brin did not mention, and is not, although it is, I think, mentioned in some of the papers, Dr. Bracamontes is a Mexican national. He freely comes and goes, and in fact, he has some family in Mexico. Now, we have a concern in a case like that that someone, in fact, like Dr. Bracamontes, might go back to Mexico and not return to the state of Texas. We have no control over him. We have no process that would force him to appear at trial absent a settlement agreement which requires his cooperation.
It strikes me we're engaged in a process that's more properly to take place in the court below. If I could direct you to my problem with the procedural posture of the case. Let's say that the trial court erred in certifying now and asking questions later. It appears that the trial court certified and determined all asked certification questions at the fairness hearing. Let's presume that that was error for purposes of this argument. And that at the time MMC brought this interlocutory appeal, because of the nature of these type proceedings, they get there on standing because the claims are similar against the two parties. The claims are no longer similar. And what are we to do with that?
Well, I think the court should dismiss the appeal as being without jurisdiction. I don't think there is conflicts jurisdiction in the true sense of the word.
Well,
as I read
we do
the court's
have
opinion.
Jurisdiction to determine whether the Court of Appeals properly exercises jurisdiction. And the Court of Appeals determined that it was premature because the certification issues would be decided at the settlement hearing, which appears to be contradictory of Bloyett. So we can reach the question in evaluating whether the CA properly evaluated their jurisdiction.
Justice O'Neill, I think your question raises three important issues. The first issue is, was there in fact a class certification proceeding in the court below, the trial court, and was that subject to revisiting at the fairness hearing in accordance with Bloyett? And I think if the court looks at both the record, and I might cite the court to page 8, page 17, page 29 of the June 8th transcript on class certification, where it states, the class should be certified temporarily for purposes of evaluating the settlement. All we're asking for today is preliminary approval, not final approval. The court is not bound in any way to give final approval to a class certification order.
But there is no such thing for purposes of the appeal statute, interlocutory appeal statute, as a preliminary certification.
That, I think, is the second issue that your question raises. Because, in fact, I don't disagree with you, but I think the standard under which you evaluate that class certification will be different. Now, unless this court wants to overrule its opinion in Bloyett, the procedure that's been set up and been followed and was approved explicitly in Bloyett, and I can read the...
That was before Amkim.
Well, actually, Your Honor, Amkim...
And Ortiz.
Amkim and Ortiz, and I don't think that this point is at all at odds with what happened in Amkim. The issue is not, in the settlement class context, the issue is not whether a settlement class must meet the standards of either Rule 42 or Rule 23 under the federal procedure, but when does that occur? And in the context of a settlement class, what this court said in Bloyett, and what I believe is correct procedure in the federal courts today, is that the preliminary class certification is done, and it must meet, similar to preliminary approval of a class settlement, it must be within a range. It must appear to the court, based on, in this case, the court had affidavits of the class representative, affidavits of class counsel. It also had the petition. It had a settlement agreement. I think the first issue is, does it meet the smell test?
Well,
then the issue was...
How does, under those circumstances, if you're talking about affidavit proof to support a preliminary certification decision as opposed to the full-blown evidentiary record that may be required to support the actual certification or later certification, on what basis would a court review that decision for the proper exercise of discretion?
I think that's...
Does this mean that there would be no review of such decisions by appellate courts? That it is essentially unreviewable because as long as you put something before the trial court, you get your class preliminarily certified and we can wait later and actually have certification proceedings in connection with the fairness hearing?
Well, Justice Hankinson, you answer your own question, I think, when you say, as long as something's put in front of the trial court. I mean, I think there's something has to be put in front of the trial court. You have to meet, as I said, a minimum standard. You have to have affidavits. The case law in Texas is you can certify on the petition.
And my question to you, what is it that must be put before the trial court, and how does an appellate court review that?
I think that's an important issue. In my opinion, it is important that the trial court see not more than just the petition. In this case, the court did see affidavits of not only the class representative, but also affidavits of class counsel, There was the petition before the court. There was the settlement agreement before the court. There was, in fact, a hearing conducted on the 8th, and there were 3 days given for MMC to file objections, and the court did have an opportunity to consider those objections before issuing its order on the 11th. Now, but the order itself is preliminary, however, and it's important.
I want to ask you right there.
Yes, sir.
What do you think is the criteria that establishes the right of the trial court to grant a preliminary order? What does the party or a group have to show?
I think that the court has to, based on a review of the affidavits and the evidence submitted.
What about applying the criteria of Rule 42 to this request to preliminarily certify a class? Shouldn't that order meet all those requirements?
Well,
even if it's supposed to be a settlement class.
And Justice Baker, if the court wants to overrule Bloyed,
tell me why you think Bloyed can get where it got without having met Rule 42.
Well, let me read to you Bloyed.
Go ahead.
And the opinion from the court. We think that a plenary, first, the court sided with approval Newberg. The actual class ruling is deferred in settlement class actions until after hearing on the settlement approval following notice to the class.
But that's not what happened here. It was certified before the settlement, and Bloyed says the trial court must assume its role as guarding the class not only in approving class settlements, but also in deciding whether to certify a class in the first place.
Justice O'Neill, what was done was a temporary class or a preliminary class was certified solely to give notice to the class.
I'm having a hard time following that reasoning, because there is no such thing as preliminary. It was certified, notice went out, and it is appealable.
Then I guess my question to you, Justice O'Neill, is how do you give notice to a class? Unless a class has been certified. Now, what Newberg says and what Bloyed says, and it's, again, let me read, if I might, this court said, in citing Newberg with approval, the actual class ruling is deferred in settlement class actions until after hearing on the settlement approval following notice to the class. Now, how do you give notice to the class without certifying the class?
How do you preliminarily certify without stringently meeting the requirements of Rule 42?
Well, how do you preliminarily approve a settlement agreement? I think the point is this. In the settlement context, and again, what the court said in Bloyed is, we think that a plenary hearing with the opportunity for questioning by the court and vigorous cross-examination by counsel representing objecting class members should be the general rule. In conducting a plenary hearing on a proposed class action settlement, the trial court must resolve two primary issues. One, whether to certify the class under Rule 42, meeting the requirements of Rule 42, and two, whether the settlement is fair, adequate, and reasonable, considering the six fall factors.
If we look at the record that was before the trial court at the point in time it issued its preliminary certification order, is it your position that we could determine, applying the requirements of Rule 42, that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in certifying a class based on the record before it? We apply the usual Rule 42 standards under the law that exists. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in certifying that class?
I think it did not, in the context of a settlement class and Bloyed.
I just want to talk generally. I'm not talking about in the context of a settlement class. You're up here after class certification order. This is it.
Right.
Under Rule 42, did the trial court abuse its discretion in certifying the class based on the record before it?
I don't believe so.
Why not?
I believe that it had the requisite evidence in front of it to determine that the class met the numerosity, commonality, and typicality requirements and the adequacy requirements of Rule 42. But, Justice Hankinson, the point is, do you want to have, and again, the court can do this. You can make new law if you want to. You can say, we're going to require a full-blown class certification hearing at the preliminary approval stage before notice goes out to the class. Now, what you sacrifice by that is you elevate the position of someone like MMC, who has no standing, I believe, and has is not a class member, is not a settling defendant. you elevate them into a position that is superior to that of class members.
No, sir. So, all I'm trying to determine is you're asking us to follow Boyette in a way that says this kind of procedure in this case is acceptable. And I'm asking you, what is a trial? What is a class lawyer supposed to give to a trial judge, and what standard is a trial judge to review in order to determine that, yes, it's okay to preliminarily certify a class when and all we have is Rule 42, and we do have law interpreting, applying Rule 42 to determine whether or not there's sufficiency. What does it, I mean, you're saying, yes, you should be able to do this and hear all these good reasons, but it's, I'm asking you what it looks like and what standard is to be followed by trial courts in making this determination, and what standards are appellate courts supposed to use in reviewing it.
And I think the standards are the standards that the court has set in the past for those type of proceedings. This court, not, you know, Judge Aparicio did not do this in Hidalgo County. This court has set up a two-track process for class certification, and that process is dependent on whether or not there is a settlement. Now, again, the court doesn't have to do that if it doesn't want to. Newberg suggests that that is the appropriate way to go forward. I would suggest it also is the appropriate way to go forward. The reason for that is this.
It may be the appropriate way to go forward, but because the trial court can at any time decertify a class after it's certified a class, I'm not sure I see any difference between whether there's a certification for the purposes of notice for settlement and certification for the purposes of a full-blown class action lawsuit. In terms of the effect is that even though there's an interim appeal on the certification and the court of appeal says that that's fine, the trial court, because of subsequent evidence, could always determine not to. So it would not be inconsistent for Boyd to say, well, make a preliminary determination about class, send out the notice, but the trial court still must, in the fairness hearing, take into consideration the efficacy of the class. It seems to me that that's not inconsistent.
And I don't disagree with that as a general statement, but this court, in other opinions, has noted that once you go through a class certification process, there is a presumption created. And so the issue, I think, for the court is, in the interest of achieving the best decision on class certification, at what point in that process do you want to have a full-blown class certification hearing? Do you want to have it at the preliminary stage when you've got a settlement and before you've given notice to the class so that no class member has an opportunity to appear and participate because they won't know about it, except for the class representative who presumably is in favor of the settlement? Or in a settlement context, do you want to have a preliminary class certification for purposes of giving notice so that then you can have a full-blown class certification hearing where these issues can be joined by both proponents and opponents of the settlement? And that, I think, gives rise to the best decision-making on class certification. You know, the court has done, I mean, this is the way it works, and this is the way Boyette set it out for this to work. And this is what happened in Hidalgo County, and if you read the record, it's a transcript that I've identified. The court made it very clear. This was preliminary approval for notice only. And there was going to be a full-blown class certification hearing at which point all of these issues would have to be addressed. And that would be in accordance with Boyette. And that would be after notice to the class. Again, the question is, shouldn't we give class members the opportunity to appear?
Judge Enoch's question.
I'm sorry.
Is there another question? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I wanted to address two points, if I may. The first one is about the fairness hearing that is yet to come. First, unless somebody says we have standing, we won't get to participate. But the way the order is written, only people who make objections can participate. And it defines those people as class members, as the people who file the objections. But there will also be a spillover, and I realize it was discussed earlier. The four new claimants who are only suing the hospital, allege about three or four basic claims. But one of the claims those four people are alleging is that Dr. Bracamontes was not board certified. They and the other class they want to represent should have been told, and they weren't told. That's one of the class. Yeah, there's the thing about the equipment. Yes, there's the corporate practice of medicine, but at least 25 or 30% of their allegations focus on Dr. Bracamontes' lack of certification and whether that should have been told. Now, that's exactly what the court will review at the fairness hearing. If the court at that hearing concludes that those claims are cohesive enough to warrant certification under B3, that's got to carry over to the next hearing, because how can he tell the settlement class those allegations will form the basis of a certifiable class, and then turn around and tell essentially the same group, but over in this class with these people who are raising the same allegations among others, you aren't. That just won't
work. How do you respond to, if I understand Mr. Cottle's argument on one aspect, for a settlement class, this is going to settle the case, and this is going to be the end of it, as opposed to trying the lawsuit and the jury making findings of fact and the trial court providing the judgment on that at the other end. A settlement has sort of an implication of ad litem, looking out for the interest of the settling parties. Mr. Cottle raised this specter that maybe there's a reason for having a preliminary certification class without a full-blown hearing that generates this class for the purposes of a notice, with the idea that the classification actually occur after the notice, and therefore you have this aspect of prospective class members actually having an opportunity to participate in the class action certification hearing. Is that a reason why this might be a premature appeal, because you really haven't had the class action certification hearing yet?
No. This class with these people who are raising the same allegations among others, you aren't. That just won't fly.
How do you respond to, if I understand Mr. Cottle's argument on one aspect, for a settlement class, this is going to settle the case, and this is going to be the end of it, as opposed to trying a lawsuit and the jury making findings of fact and the trial court providing the judgment on that at the other end. A settlement has sort of an implication of ad litem, looking out for the interest of the settling parties. Mr. Cottle raised this specter that maybe there's a reason for having a preliminary certification class without a full-blown hearing that generates this class for the purposes of a notice, with the idea that the classification actually occur after the notice, and therefore you have this aspect of prospective class members actually having an opportunity to participate in the class action certification hearing. Is that a reason why this might be a premature appeal, because you really haven't had the class action certification hearing yet?
No, and I think the answer to it is sort of historical, which you get if you do read Nodeberg. The first one was that before the 1990s, courts didn't even think you could have tentative settlement classes. And so they sent the notices out before they certified, and the certification would take place at the hearing. The idea of a tentative preliminary certification came after some people saying, well, we think you can actually have these beasts. And so there was originally a time when courts would just send out the notice that we're going to have a certification hearing, class members, to conclude this settlement, and we're going to take both issues up. And so, in other words, there is no logical legal reason why you certify the class when you send out the notice about the fairness hearing, where we're going to take the whole thing up. It's largely historical, but it has acquired a significance which I'd like to point out here, and that is the power that certification gives the trial court and the class representative. The reason why I think tentative class certifications have become popular, and I use that word guardedly, is that it gives the court and the class rep tremendous powers to shut down rival litigation. The court has the power to regulate the defendant's communications with the class. He no longer can put notices in the paper or talk to them willy-nilly. It requires the same powers to shut down rivals from doing that. As we saw in the St. Louis Railway case, they can even issue injunctions as part of preliminary certifications to order class members to stop their litigation in their tracks. While that wasn't done in this case, I think what that counsels is that if you're going to do preliminary certification to give the court, to give the class rep these powers and assume control over the class, then the same standards to guard the class against abuse at later steps in revision apply at that point as well. And I think I've reached the end of my remarks unless the court has more questions.
Any questions? That concludes today's arguments. The court will consider these arguments on briefs and the orals presented today. And we'll ask the marshal to adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.